Today is July 17th, the year 2000. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. David Anderson for the Michigan State University Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial to be commemorated in the year 2005. Dr. Anderson, you see we're tape recording this today. You give us permission to record this interview.
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to start first with your educational and professional background. Where'd you go to school? And
well, that becomes a little complicated and embarrassing.
Because
I went as an undergraduate to five different schools.
I see.
On the GI Bill. They revised that for the Korean War. You could only transfer once.
Oh.
But then whenever I got bored someplace, I went someplace else.
Uh-huh.
Including going to Mexico for spring break for 2 weeks, and I stayed 8 months. Rather interesting. But then I wound up at Bowling Green State in Ohio, and I found two things there that captured my interest. One was American literature, taught by Emerson Schuck, and the other was the young woman who became my wife. So I finished at Bowling Green. I stayed there about a year and a half, I think, and stayed there for my MA. I was recalled back into the Army for the Korean War. Got out in the fall of 1953. I had originally intended when I got out, and they promised me that I would be out by the 1st of September. I was not out by the 1st of September, but I had an assistantship lined up at Ohio State, was going to work on my PhD. I got out the second week in October instead, which was too late. So I began job hunting, and I had three job offers. One at Auburn, Alabama for $1,800 a year. One at the University of Maine for $2,400 a year. And one at General Motors Institute in Flint for $4,800 a year, which was a lot of money then. In fact, when I took the job there, all my friends wanted jobs there too, because it was more money than they were making. But anyway, took the job at Flint, and the following spring I began taking courses over here for my PhD, largely because I discovered that Russell Nye was a resident not only of the state of Michigan, but a faculty member at Michigan State University.
And you were familiar with his work.
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, and Emerson Schuck and Russ Nye were classmates at Wisconsin working for their PhDs, working under Harry Hayden Clark. And Schuck kept telling me for years Russ Nye was the best American lit man in the country. Russ and I began telling me that Emerson Schuck was the best American lit man in the country. So I had the best of both possible worlds.
Mm-hmm.
And then Russ always referred to me as Harry Hayden Clark's grandson.
Intellectual family,
yeah.
Tree.
Well, anyway, I drove back and forth to Flint and took courses part-time here for about a year and a half, and then I came over full-time in the spring of 1956, and on a leave of absence from General Motors Institute. Of course, I had never had any intention of going back.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I drove back and forth, taking a full load, 56, 57, and then moved over here from Flint, quit my job in Flint, moved over here in the summer of 56, and took a job in what was then Communication Skills, which became later the Department of American Thought and Language. Again, I had no intention of staying. Here some 43 years later, I'm still here for two reasons. One, of course, was that I've enjoyed myself tremendously here. And the other is that the place has always been pretty good to me. I enjoyed and continue to enjoy colleagueship with a number of very good people. Oh, during the years, every once in a while, I get the bug to move on. Mention it to Russ and I, and Russ would always say, remember, Dave, every place is bad. And of course, I'd say, well, what's the point? And
but that issue of loyalty, or whatever you want to call it, it seems to be a prominent theme coming through a lot of these interviews where people came to Michigan State with the idea of just staying a few years.
And I know lots of them.
The whole year, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
And of course, I enjoyed my PhD program. It was A1, first rate, better than you could get almost any place in the country. Mm-hmm. Russ was my chairman. There were some very, very good people in English at that time. Jim Rust, Harry Hoppe, whole list. Mm-hmm. I won't name all the names, but it was a first-rate department of first-rate people. Mm-hmm. And so I enjoyed myself. I always remember my final oral defending my dissertation. And 36 members of the faculty came, and one of them even took pictures. Jim Rust took pictures. Some wonderful.
You've
pictures.
Got some of those. Yeah. Books. Yeah. What was the subject of your dissertation?
It was on Sherwin Anderson. Okay. Topic was it was a full critical and biographical study of mm-hmm. Sherwin Anderson's work. Since been published. And, of course, I've maintained my interest in Sherwood Anderson from that day to this. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've done 4 more books on him. And, of course, one of the key elements in founding the Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature here in 1971 was, of course, my interest in Sherwood Anderson and in Midwestern writers generally. I've done books on Abraham Lincoln, and Lewis Bromfield, and Brand Whitlock, and a number of others, all of them Midwestern, and one book, incidentally, on Woodrow Wilson, who was almost a Midwesterner. Well, literally, he was his father and mother married in Pennsylvania, and he was a seminary graduate, and some of his relatives took jobs in the Columbus, Ohio area. His father, instead of taking a job in Ohio, as he could have, took a job in Staunton, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And there, of course, is where Woodrow mm-hmm. was born. And where he, and then, of course, his father moved to South Carolina, no, Georgia, Augusta, Georgia. Mm-hmm. And he developed his Southern identity, mm-hmm. but he's really a Midwesterner at heart.
Almost.
Both of his grandfathers lived in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. I had intended later to ask you about the SSML, but since how you brought it up already, let's go ahead and talk a little bit about that. What motivated you to be one of the driving force behind the establishing of this new scholarly society?
Well, I'd always been interested, as I said, in the whole range of Midwestern writers, Anderson, Dreiser, Lewis, many, many others. As I said, I did books on a number of them. But what struck me was that the Midwest MLA program in St. Louis in 1969, I was on the Modern American Literature program. Alexander Kern from Iowa was on the program, and Sanford Maravitz from Kent State was also on the program. Kern gave a paper on Dreiser. Maravitz gave a paper on F. Scott Fitzgerald, and I gave a paper on Sherwood Anderson. For no reason except chance, I suppose, my paper was last. So I sat there listening to these papers and seeing how they were tying in with things that I was going to talk about in mine. Mm-hmm. So it struck me that there's something here that we should look at. And I didn't know what to call it, Midwesternness or something of the sort. Mm-hmm. So I suggested to the executive secretary of Midwest MLA that we have a program that would explore this, see if there is anything to it. And he said, well, I don't think anybody would come. So I said, well, we'll see. And I wrote to a number of friends, who all of whom had Midwestern backgrounds, one kind or another, including Russ Nye and Emerson Schuck and others, and suggested that we get together to talk about this. So the response was very enthusiastic. So we started calling ourselves the Society for the Study of Midwestern Literature. Mm-hmm. We've had our first meeting in the fall of 1971. We've met every year since. Our first meeting was a one-day program. We had about 16 people here, I think. And we had a lot of fun, enjoyed talking about what we liked to talk about, and decided to continue it. So 30 years later, it's still active.
How many members now?
Well, there's somewhere between 400 and 500. I'm mm-hmm. not sure exactly. But we always have a turnout of at least 100 at the annual conference. We also sponsor programs at Modern Language Association, Midwest MLA, Pop Culture, and the American Literature Association. Of course, they're all well attended, contrary to the then executive secretary, Sherman Paul, who said that nobody would come. I delighted in needling with him about that for years afterwards.
When did you start the journal?
The newsletter started in 71.
Okay.
The Midwestern Miscellany started in 73, and Mid-America started in 74. And we're still going strong.
Mm-hmm. Was there what motivated you to found the new journal? Was there an outlet, or were you getting opposition from publishers?
There was a good deal of interest in it from almost everybody except librarians.
Oh.
Jim West, who was then head of the Newbery, I approached him about it, see what he thought, and he said, oh, not another journal. Too many journals now, which of course may or may not be true. But anyway, he was the only negative voice. Others warned me that academic journals are often very short-lived. Another one said, well, why not? So I thought, well, why not? Let's do it. And we did it. And of course, over 25 years later, it's still going strong.
Mm-hmm. So, and what were your roles in the organization? What jobs did you do?
Well, for the first 2 years of the society, I was elected president. Mm-hmm. Then after that, I became executive secretary, largely because it was too hard to handle to hand records and financial records and checkbooks and things to new secretary treasurers every year. So then I took on the role of executive director, and Roger Resnahan took over the duties of secretary treasurer. But we've had remarkable membership loyalty. It's amazing how many people who've been in it at the beginning are still coming.
Still members. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Some are getting pretty old, including myself.
Are there any special, obviously, study of literature in the Midwest, but is there any intellectual niche that you think that the group has certainly carved out for itself?
Well, I think much of the interest is in fiction. There's some interest in poetry, but the majority of interest is in fiction. Then, of course, we have a lot of practicing poets who are members. At the conference every year, it actually has two dimensions. One is exploring the cultural heritage of the Midwest, which largely focuses on literature and largely on fiction. But then we also have the concurrent Midwest Poetry Festival, in which practicing poets and other writers read from their works. Then in 1985, we began to give two awards. First, the Mid-America Award for somebody who's done very distinguished work in the study of Midwestern literature. And then that was in 78, we began that. Then in 1980, we began the Mark Twain Award, which is given to a distinguished Midwestern writer. And in 1985, we gave the Mark Twain Award to Gwendolyn Brooks, who was so enthusiastic about the society and what we were doing, that she decided she would fund two prizes every year, $500 prizes. One for the best poem read in the poetry festival, and the other for the best poet paper read in the Midwestern Heritage dimension. We have continued those awards, added one other for the best piece of prose fiction read. And so we have three annual awards given at the annual conference. We also continue to give the Mark Twain Award to a distinguished Midwestern writer and the Mid-America Award to a distinguished Midwestern scholar.
Did the university support the group at all, or either from the beginning or?
Actually, I've had a theory from the very beginning. I've seen too many journals and some organizations killed because an institution has supported it in flush financial times. And when things get a bit tight, it's one of the first things they kill. Some very good journals have died that way. So I made up my mind from the very beginning that we would not only not give any institution any kind of control over the organization, but we would also not accept any money from them. So the society has been self-funding from the very beginning, and it still is. And then I get a wonderful letter today in which somebody says he's going to leave us $25,000 in his will. Mm-hmm. So, but it's always been self-funding, self-supporting. Now the university has contributed space, mm-hmm. and that obviously is an important contribution. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it's not something that if we were deprived of would kill the organization.
Right.
We'd have to work out of a vest pocket or something, but we would survive. Mm-hmm. Whereas too often the institution funds the thing and then sees an opportunity to save a little money by cutting out the funding, and mm-hmm. the institution or the journal simply dies. Mm-hmm. Number of good Midwestern journals have died for that reason. Mm-hmm. The Old Northwest, that was published at Miami University, was killed about 4 years ago. The institution decided not to fund it anymore. Mm-hmm. Great Lakes Review was killed, was at Central Michigan University in its last legs, and then Central decided not to fund it anymore. Mm-hmm. Killed that.
So the pattern's there. Yeah.
So. They can't take our money away from us because they have no control over it. I think that's important.
Sounds like a good strategy. Let's go back to when you first arrived on campus, or let's say after you got your degree. You started in communication. What was the name of the department at that time?
It was Department of Communication Skills.
Communication Skills. Okay.
And Paul Bagwell was the chairman. Mm-hmm. And well, the only person still around who came the same year I did was Bern Engel.
Okay.
Well, most of them are not really gone, but dead. Mm. Dreadful thought, isn't it?
How was the campus different then?
Well, the size was certainly different. When I came, there were about 18,000 students. And it was in the midst of very rapid expansion. 18,000 students seemed like a lot of students, and it was. in terms of most other institutions. But of course, it just grew and grew and grew. In fact, in the late 60s, I heard President Hanna remark that he was convinced we would have 80,000 students by 1980. And I suspect the projection was not all that inaccurate. What he didn't foresee was the tremendous growth of community colleges. Mm-hmm. There were only about two in the state then, and there was a tremendous growth in them in the late 50s and early 60s, mm-hmm. and through the 60s. And then, too, the growth of other four-year institutions like Grand Valley and others.
Saginaw Valley.
And then, too, of course, the growth of branch campuses. Mm-hmm. And the state colleges, Western, Central, Eastern, becoming universities, mm-hmm. and absorbing a lot more students. Mm-hmm. So the those schools are now about where MSU was when I came. They all have about 18,000 students. Mm-hmm. Well, if all those kids had come here, would have had probably 100,000 students by now. Thank God. Yeah. Traffic is bad enough as it is.
But the other faculty, when you first came, were jobs tough to get at that time?
The 50s were a fairly tight period. Mm-hmm. Lots of hiring of temporary faculty for meeting the expansion. And the 60s then were the boom years. Anybody who could virtually read and write could get a job teaching English someplace. And of course, faculties expanded considerably. I was on the interviewing team for what by then was American Thought and Language, and we would interview at MLA and elsewhere. We would interview 200 applicants and hope that we could hire six. Mm-hmm. And usually we could hire about six. Mm-hmm. But every place was hiring, and they were all tenure stream jobs. So there was lots of competition. But some of the people whom we hired during those years are still here, mm-hmm. and some even still active. But the last good hiring year, I think it was 1969. And suddenly something happened in the 70s. And I think part of it was the movement toward larger classes every place. And above all, the movement toward hiring temporaries. We began to hire temporaries in the 70s, and largely at first because we couldn't fill regular slots, but then the temporary slots became permanent temporary slots. Mm-hmm. And temporaries were kept for, at one time they were kept for 6 years and then let go. Mm-hmm. And that since, of course, has been reduced to about 2 years most places. But unfortunately, this has meant that a lot of young people have been forced almost literally to become permanent temporaries, mm-hmm. jumping from one school to another, and that annoys me no end. Mm-hmm. I think very sincerely and very strongly that no institution, especially an institution that produces PhDs, has the right to refuse to hire PhDs to fill their slots in tenure stream positions. Mm-hmm. I suspect if all the temporary slots on this campus were filled by tenure stream faculty, we would see an entirely different faculty makeup. We'd mm-hmm. see a much younger faculty with a strong voice in academic affairs, mm-hmm. which would not be a bad thing.
Mm-hmm. Were you involved in department administration? In the ATL department?
I served in every committee. I never had any interest in administration. Mm-hmm. But I did spend a 5-year tour as assistant dean, which was an interesting experience. I was mostly interested in faculty development, and so I worked in that area, developing conferences and courses and programs. And
who was dean
and
at
whatnot.
That time? College of Arts and Letters?
No,
or
University,
was it University,
University
College.
College.
Okay.
Which is something we haven't talked about.
Right. Right.
But I had no interest whatsoever in becoming a career administrator.
Mm-hmm. What were the courses that you taught? Was it primarily in the department here, or?
Well, and college-wide.
College-wide.
We had 300 and 400 level general education courses, which we devoted a great variety of subjects to, all of them interdisciplinary, and as far as possible, drawing on the talent from the four University College departments: natural science, social science, American thought and language, and humanities. And we did some interesting things. In fact, we were moving very, very strongly in that direction when, in fact, had started a humanities coordinating committee, which was a joint organization of the College of Arts and Letters and University College. I was chairman of it. And our function was to develop courses and programs that would focus on the non-Western world, the humanities of the non-Western world. We sponsored a number of seminars, brought in distinguished scholars from Africa and Asia, and sponsored seminars in the summer for Michigan State faculty so that they could become interested in and perhaps develop programs in non-Western humanities. It was very successful until one thing happened, and that, of course, was when the powers that be, and I could tell you the man's name, who never had any use for University College, decided as his final gesture, final stroke of power, I suppose, as provost, to do away with University College. So he did. And undergraduate education, and particularly interdisciplinary undergraduate education, has not only never been the same since, but from what I hear from the students, it's never been very good since.
Mm-hmm. That provost was Clarence Winder?
Clarence Winder, yeah, Lee Winder.
Yeah. What do you think motivated the attack on University College?
Well, it was always present. One thing that I think gave University College its original impetus was that a lot of senior faculty thought that they could shove all the lower level courses in here and then they wouldn't have to teach them. Mm-hmm. I know that was true in English.
Mm-hmm.
English saw this as a means of getting rid of freshman composition, which of course they did. Nobody mm-hmm. had to grade freshman papers anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, too, there were a lot of people who were hostile to the idea of general education, hostile to the idea of interdisciplinary education, and I think, too, hostile to the idea that here were senior faculty teaching lower level courses. They should properly, they thought, be taught by graduate students, a philosophy that I have never supported. I think undergraduates and lower level undergraduates deserve the best we've got. And that's what they were getting mm-hmm. with the University College.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly, it was a shock.
Was it tied in at all with the residential college?
No, the residential colleges were... We worked together with the residential colleges. We staffed some of their courses and whatnot. There were great plans for the future of the residential colleges. I was on the committee that was developing the program for the fourth residential college, which was going to be based on the great books idea. And then suddenly the powers that be decided that there would be no more residential colleges, combined with the fact that Justin Morrill had lost its direction, let me put it that way. Justin Morrill was founded as an internationally oriented humanities college. And all the students were required to take 4 years of two foreign languages, most of them French and Russian. Well, the students began to feel that that was an unwarranted burden and began to complain about the foreign language requirement. Somebody, I think I know who, but I wouldn't swear to it, decided that, they really shouldn't have to take two foreign languages. Let's make it optional. So made it optional and nobody took foreign language. Well, of course, what happened was that it lost its orientation. Mm-hmm. It lost this international flavor that was at the heart of the college. And it began to become a very, very experimental and